The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now on KMRE and KAVZ. I'm Dave Willingham, joined by co-host Tim Johnson. Stephanie Contreras is not with us this evening, and we are joined by Matt Crow, Extreme Oil Campaign Director with the regional advocacy group Stand.Earth on local and state efforts to halt fossil fuel transportation, oil spills, and how it's all connected. But first, the Whatcom 3 trial begins October 9th. Our own Stephanie Contreras sat down with activist Josefina Alanis Mora about the changes, about the charges, the protest, and what's next.
Catch us up from where this started. This incident or alleged incident happened May in 2016. What happened exactly?
So as many of us know, most of us know in the county, Trump decided to host one of his rallies up here in Linden back in May 2016. Many of us in the community decided that we wanted to do something to, you know, voice our concerns against him being here and being in the county, and just his rhetoric in general, not only on just hate, but the fact that rhetoric has really fueled hate in our community and really escalated a lot of violence against our people that already existed, especially against people of color. And so there was a big community that did an action, and three of us were arrested for blocking the Guide Meridian Road. We created a blockade, and we still are being prosecuted for that. We finally have our trial coming up next Monday, the 9th. And so that's what we're here to talk about.
And it wasn't just the three of you who were blocking the road, is that correct?
It was just the three of us, but we had a lot of people surrounding us. Only three of us were locked down, and there was a lot of people that were rallying next to us and supporting us and making sure that those that were angry weren't able to come and, you know, attack us.
And so there's been some question about the evidence in terms of the arrest. And I know that there have been a couple of requests to maybe dismiss this case. Tell me about what happened in terms of the people, the officials who were making the arrest. Were they filming you, or were they not? Were you on camera?
So it was hard to tell for me as someone who was very distracted on, you know, trying to make sure that everyone was okay and that there was a big reaction against us. However, it seemed like there was police obviously recording not only through video cameras, but with their cars as well. We asked for evidence pretty early on, and the prosecution kept delaying, and it seems like that evidence was eventually destroyed. Which just shows how scared they are to be able to admit that they were wrong in prosecuting people who are trying to, you know, have their right to a free speech.
So your defense team asked for the footage.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, when they didn't actually destroy it originally, they just delayed. And then they destroyed it later?
Yeah, and so we have some great lawyers who are part of the community, and they, you know, immediately filed for all the evidence that they could, that we needed, and they kept delaying, and it wasn't until December that we said, you know, this evidence still hasn't been brought to us, and that was when it was brought to our attention that it had been destroyed, if it even had existed.
But the judge did not accept that as a cause for dismissal of the case.
No, the judge has been extremely biased, I believe. At first, you know, you think that the judge is going to be impartial, and that's what, you know, when you watch Law and Order or you watch Dateline, like, you think that the judge is going to be impartial. But in reality, the prosecutor hasn't really had to do a lot of work, it seems like.
You were compelled to join the group that was protesting Trump. Tell me a little bit about your personal or your political passions for doing so.
Sure. I'm the daughter of two undocumented Mexican immigrants. I grew up with my mom being an activist for immigrant rights. And so I kind of grew up around political activism. And, you know, seeing Trump's rhetoric against not only Mexican people, but against Muslims, against all immigrants, against people in the LGBTQ community, especially being a queer person myself, I felt very compelled to let people know in this community that, you know, I'm not going to stand for this, especially being new to the community. I've only lived here about 2 or 3 years. But I thought it was ridiculous that, you know, this community would allow a guy as stupid and as hateful as him to come and fuel more anger into our community that already faces a lot of problem.
And I hear that. And I also would hear other people in the community maybe say, well, doesn't he have a right to free speech?
I think that, you know, that's an interesting argument, because when we talk about free speech, we have to remember what that's really based on and what the Constitution was founded on, what the country was founded on, which was hate and bigotry and genocide and enslavement of people of color. So I think that it's important to note that, you know, people of color's voices and opinions have been dismissed, disregarded, and legally put down and oppressed for so long that it's important for our voices to be at the forefront and for the issues that have been impacting us for centuries and centuries to really, you know, come to an end. That's what we're talking about.
So some countries, or many countries, have hate speech laws, and that is seen as something that might protect people but can also be abused. The United States does not have hate speech laws. Do you think that that's something we should have as a country?
Oh, definitely. And I think that'd be very difficult because, again, the country is founded on hate. But I think that it is important because so many people have been let off just because they have a right to protect themselves or to free speech, such as, you know, Trayvon Martin, how his killer was able to, you know, because he was scared, he was able to kill a young boy. So it's things like that that I think really prevent us from being able to take those kind of laws into account.
So this is an interesting case because it's been charged as a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so? Okay, so you were blocking the road that he was going to be traveling down? Is that?
No, we mostly wanted to make a statement. We knew it wasn't possible to find out where he was coming through. You know, there's a lot of little roads down in Linden. But it was mostly about the message. That's what mostly we wanted to get out. And it was mostly for the community as well, because, you know, Trump doesn't really listen to people, obviously. And so it was mostly about getting the message out in a way that was inconvenient for people. And you know what? We want to notice that, or let people know that inconvenience really is not any sort of harm. And it seems like the county wants to make political speech into a type of harm in the community when it's really not that. It's just an inconvenience for people because they're not used to it.
Well, we've certainly seen that with State Senator Doug Erickson.
Mm-hmm.
And he had something to do with bringing this case to trial. Is that correct?
I'm not quite sure about that, but I do know that he did after we were beginning our hearings. He brought in that law that would essentially make it a federal crime and a felony to, you know, do any kind of action that would impede economic stability, something like that. But it was essentially criminalizing our right to free speech.
So this connects with other incidents or other situations that have happened in our county in the past year. I was on the freeway as part of the freeway protest with Red Line Salish Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, that has recently come up with a groundbreaking historical Facebook warrant.
Mm-hmm.
But the situations are somewhat similar. There is a time-honored tradition in protest being disruptive to bring attention. At the same time, there's a time-honored tradition of people knowing that they broke a state or city law in order to do that, and then serving time sort of nobly. Do you think that there's a difference in the way that these cases are being fought, that you're fighting this case?
Well, I think that they're both the same, as in they both, you know, are targeting free speech. And it's really, we want to do it in a way that inconveniences people and really makes people think. You know, when I was on the blockade at Trump's rally, someone said, why can't you just sign, like hold a sign on the side of the road? And I was thinking, you know, would you really look at that? And would you still not yell at me if I was holding a sign on the side of the road? And, you know, I think that it's also interesting that I think that our case is being used as a model against the blockade that happened on the freeway as well. I think that it's being used as an excuse because people were really angry because of that blockade. But I think that the community's response is really an indicator of just how much hate there still is in our community. And I think that also the way that they're targeting myself and the other people on our case, I'm a third-year student with a 3.6 GPA. I've never had any run-ins with the law. I'm a model citizen, and yet they're still treating me as if I really did break a law and that I don't have the right to free speech. And so, you know, sitting in the courtrooms and especially watching all these different cases go by in our hearings, I just wonder how they must treat people who do have a lot of run-ins with the law. I'm very light-skinned, white-passing. How do they treat, you know, people of color, darker people, black people, people who don't speak the language? There's been cases of people who need interpreters. And so I think this really connects to the bigger picture that not only are people who are model citizens who are just trying to have their free speech rights heard being prosecuted, but as well, how does this connect to how people of color who do have run-ins with the law are treated? And, you know, it is a question. The criminal court always thinks, the judge keeps telling us, the jury's not going to tell you, they're not going to ask why you did this, but did you do it or not? And that's the problem with this criminal justice system. They don't ask, why do people do what they do? And we see a lot of times that people have to commit crimes because of their survival needs, because of poverty, because of lack of education, all these kind of problems. And so I think that that's the bigger issue that arises with this, is that the criminal justice system doesn't say, why do people do what they do? It's just, do they do it or not?
Right. And then in some instances, I think that does come into play, whether somebody's charged for murder or manslaughter. Sometimes that like, what are the reasons behind it, or mm-hmm. or if it's self-defense. So it's interesting that you bring up that is not the case when it comes to protest. Mm-hmm. One other aspect I wanted to bring up was I remember reading that you were threatened, or the people who were there were threatened. And can you tell me a little about that?
I can't remember exactly what it was, but we did have an instance where we were there that one person did come and essentially try to push over the ladders that we were in. And since we were locked down to the ladders and I was locked down to the other two people, it really posed a threat against us that we would have been very hurt. And I was actually almost injured by the police when they kind of dragged us off. So it was a lot of, there was a lot of quite a bit of threats in there that were, you know, possible. And we knew going into it what kind of possibilities there were. But, you know, overall, we wanted to make sure that, you know, this kind of rhetoric wasn't present, and or at least there was a big fight against the rhetoric that was being brought into our community.
As to the anti-protesters who were threatening you or harassing you, they were arrested too?
No, actually. The police was really bad at de-escalating. There was quite a few people that, you know, first they were saying, we aren't going to the rally, you know, why aren't you letting us through? And then at the end they were shouting, Trump, Trump, Trump. They climbed all over the cars. They started, you know, bouncing and jumping on the cars, keying the cars. And the police was just kind of standing there more concerned about trying to get us off of the Guide Meridian.
So it would seem that the fact that you were arrested and Mia was arrested and the Whatcom Three were arrested, and yet people who were physically threatening you were not charged at all, sort of supports your perspective.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm thankful that, you know, we had people who were there to protect us as well, because of the incident where the man came and tried to knock down our ladders. You know, the people who were yelling at us and who were trying to come and agitate us, but we had people there who were not the police, who were able to de-escalate, which was very lucky.
Josefina, is there anything else that you think the public or our community should know?
Sure. You know, these actions are very important in our community, and I think that my case is only one of many that exist around the country. And, you know, there's a whole history to civil disobedience and to direct actions. And I think that, you know, we can't be criticizing people who put their records, their lives on the line for us and for our rights. And so I really appreciate people who are able to come to the courthouse on Monday, the 9th. Our trial starts at 1:30 p.m. We also have a Facebook event for people who want to look up, I think, Imagine No Cages is a Facebook page that puts it together. So yeah, thank you so much for having me and for giving me the space to, you know, talk about my story and hopefully a story that connects with a lot of other people around the county and the country.
That was Josefina Alanis-Mora, one of the Whatcom Three. The trial in which they're charged of road obstruction during then-candidate Donald Trump's campaign visit in 2016 starts October 9th. You are listening to Cascadia News Now here on KMRE 102.3, KAVZ 102.5. And we're going to turn now to our guest host, Matt Crowe. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
What are you working on these days?
Well, I'm currently the Extreme Oil Campaign Director at a regional nonprofit called Stand.Earth. That's www.stand.earth. We have offices in San Francisco, Bellingham, and Vancouver, B.C. You know, prior to joining Stand, I worked for years at Resources, did a lot of work on the Gateway Pacific coal terminal issue, as well as some water quality work, and really came to Stand because I was concerned about the very rapidly growing issue of oil drains. And so since being at Stand, we've worked to try to defeat new oil train infrastructure, in particular offloading terminals, like the ones that we see at BP and Phillips 66 here. Those two really were moving forward before there was any organized resistance. And so my work for the last 3 or 4 years has in large part been about organizing resistance to the growth of oil infrastructure. And we've successfully defeated now 21 oil train terminals, mostly on the west coast of the U.S., but also a couple others in Albany and Maryland and a few other states.
Well, Matt, it's great to have you on the show tonight. And expanding outward from the issue of oil trains, one of the reasons we were inspired to have you on the show tonight was that there was a decision recently by the Department of Ecology to deny a key permit to the Millennium Bulk coal port down in Longview, which was analogous and similar to the Gateway Pacific Terminal that was proposed in Cherry Point. And I wonder if you could walk us through that project, the size of it, the scope of it, and what happened as a result of Ecology's action.
Sure. Honestly, this was super exciting, and should be super exciting for the, I guess it's 650,000 people now who have commented on one of the 7 coal terminals that's been proposed for Washington and Oregon going back to late 2010. When the Millennium Bulk Terminal, which had just had this permit rejected, was proposed. Shortly after that, a few months later, Gateway Pacific in February 2011 was proposed as a coal terminal in partnership with Peabody Coal. And so that was the time when the future of coal looked beautiful and bright. And there were projections of nearly infinite demand in China or India or other countries. And the reality has proved otherwise. But in the meantime, The public has participated extensively in ensuring that the state agencies take a really good hard look at what these projects mean. And they've ranged in size from a almost insignificant couple million ton terminal in Grays Harbor to the largest of them all, Gateway Pacific at 48 million tons of coal. Millennium Bulk Terminal would have been 44 million. And there's a couple more in between, but 7 out of 7 have now gone down. This is the last one that was standing. And the reason it was rejected was because the Department of Ecology and Cowlitz County actually finally had a full final EIS in front of them, the Environmental Impact Statement, the final version after edits, which looked at the full probable impacts of this project in Cowlitz County primarily, but elsewhere as well. And so it's a 401 water quality certification that they rejected. It's a one of many permits. But what they did in this analysis was look at the full environmental impact assessment and say, are there things that can't be mitigated? What can't we fix if this project goes ahead? Among them, a large increase in cancer rates in the neighborhoods around the coal terminal, congestion along the tracks, traffic congestion, not just in Cowlitz County, but going back to places like Spokane, risk of derailment increases. The list goes on. And so it was really just this one water quality certification, but the justification for rejecting it looked at a very broad scope of issues in that EIS.
Well, that was the thing that impressed me, I think, going into this. This was one of the first to come forward. This sort of set the standard for what kinds of things would be looked at. If I remember right, Ecology reached out to sister organizations in Oregon. They decided that they were going to look at impacts across the airshed. They were going to look at what the impacts of burning coal in China might look like to air quality, you know, around the area, around the globe. They looked at regional impacts of rail, and so this really set the parameters. But I guess what you had mentioned that there were several of these projects, and they all were kind of moving along in their own time frame mm-hmm. and timetable, and each one of them sort of fell apart for a different reason. For example, Cherry Point never got to this point where there was a mature EIS to look at. And I'm wondering if this sort of robust way of looking at these projects was appropriate and whether it worked satisfactorily as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one thing that we can't leave aside in talking about these projects is the sheer scope of Gateway Pacific or Millennium, the two very largest projects. Each of them, had they been built, would have had a carbon impact in terms of climate change of roughly the same size as the entire state of Washington. And that's all of our industry, that's all of our energy generation, that's all of our transportation. So some folks, you know, I think many of us were in it because of the coal issue. But when you look at the reasons behind the rejection of some of these permits, simple scope. Just massive, massive industrial projects that I don't think really have a place here. And so one of the things that was missing in this Millennium decision was any real assessment of impact on tribal fishing. Now, they mentioned it. They said, you know, we think that if somebody were to spend a lot of money analyzing impacts on tribal fishing, you would find problems. But we're not going to do that because we have these other things to do. And we can contrast that with the Gateway Pacific decision, which was prior to, as you say, the mature environmental impact statement being available. But what they did have was an assessment called the Vehicle Traffic Risk Assessment. It had been under preparation for many years prior for an earlier iteration of the project, which showed really clearly that there would be very real interference with tribal and non-tribal fishing, whether you're talking gillnet fishing, crabbing, any of the other types of fishing that happen at Cherry Point and in between. And so, you know, Millennium didn't look at that. Gateway Pacific was rejected because of it. Another one further up the Columbia River was rejected because of tribal objections to interference with fishing. And so I think, the first thing we have to recognize is the scale of these things is so far beyond anything that we really associate with industrial projects locally that it's hard to comprehend. One of the places that also played out is in rail traffic, where the unit train, so when we say unit train, we're talking about a mile and a half long train. Some of the biggest, the heaviest trains on the tracks, they don't get broken apart from beginning to end of their journey. That's why they're called unit trains. Both Gateway Pacific and Millennium would have had around 16 trains a day, 8 full, 8 empty, maybe 9 full, 9 empty. That's 25% of the rail traffic coming to the state of Washington. We already have congested areas in Spokane and elsewhere on the tracks. And so when they looked at the issues associated with Millennium, boy, they looked at, you know, we have to get grain out, we have to get fruit out, we have real uses of the tracks right now, massive interference.
So given all of that and given the full EIS and the tribal impact, does this mean that it is no longer possible for these projects to move forward in Washington State? Does that mean we're just never going to see them like these were proposed?
Well, I would say it is almost certainly the case they will not move forward. Impossible is perhaps a different criterion than I can address. I mean, at this point, Gateway Pacific still owns 1,200 acres of land at Cherry Point. It has industrial zoning, although the cutout for a pier and a wharf there, that would be the fourth one at Cherry Point. You know, there's one for Intalco, there's one for Phillips 66, there's one for BP. The cutout for the fourth pier has been removed. Somebody could reapply to the Department of Natural Resources for an aquatic lands lease. Somebody could push forward on some of these issues. I think it's a much harder lift to do now. But if you talk to the folks at Gateway Pacific, they will claim they have a current permit for their 1992 application which I think could be legally challenged and would be, but they claim they have it. Millennium still has a time window by which they can challenge the rejection of this permit. But I would say that for all intents and purposes, we're seeing the grassroots, we're seeing nonprofit organizations, we're seeing agencies take a really good look at what these types of fossil fuel projects mean and figure out ways that we can legally and effectively say no.
Now, these coal terminals are a little different beast than the oil trains that you're talking about, because they were trying to build new facilities to ship coal. But if I understand the situation properly, in many cases, the oil train thing is merely an expansion of operations that were already underway and being shipped from locations that already had a permit to do it. For example, the Anacortes facility simply expands its capacity to ship oil out of a refinery. Am I right on my characterization that the oil trains are a little different beast than the coal issue?
So I'm gonna push back on your use of the word merely an expansion for a number of reasons. But first let's divide the oil train terminals into two categories. One are very similar to the coal terminals in that they're not greenfield construction, but they're new construction. There's nothing like that in that site. And so there were three proposals on the books for Grays Harbor. Two are entirely off the books now. One they're pushing for a biofuels facility. The largest oil train proposal in North America is still being considered for Vancouver, Washington. And we're expecting a determination from the Energy Facility Siting Evaluation Council sometime very soon, perhaps just after the election, at which point the governor will actually make a decision on whether or not to approve it. So there are those that are there's no oil facility there now. It would be a new thing. What you are talking about are facility expansions at the refineries. And when you say merely an expansion, I think one of the things that is most important to consider is that it is true that the oil train facilities were likely built to help provide feedstock to the refineries. However, in December of 2015, the ban on the export of crude oil wasn't really a ban. It was onerous permitting requirements was lifted, which prevented the U.S. from exporting crude anywhere except for Canada without major special permit authorizations. And so what we're looking at right now is a change in use of these facilities. They aren't supposed to be bringing in any more crude than is used for the state of Washington. But instead, now they're bringing in more crude. We export refined product, and they have just started exporting unrefined crude. And if that continues in a meaningful way, we're threatening jobs, we're threatening the economy, and we're creating a fast track or a funnel for North American crude to other markets.
We're going to get deeper into that in just a minute. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 and KAVZ 102.5.
You love KMRE Community Radio, and you love to eat. This Tuesday, October 10th, you can do one for the other. That's right. Come down to Casa Que Pasa and order a jumbo potato burrito. For every jumbo potato burrito sold on Tuesday, October 10th, Casa Que Pasa will make a donation to KMRE. Not only that, they will match any in-house donations up to $200. So come on down. Eat a jumbo potato burrito for a good cause. KMRE, your community, your voice, your station.
My name's Michael Park, and every week on the International Americana Music Show, I'll be playing a selection of the best Americana music made solely by non-American artists, whether it's alt-country from Australia, newgrass from Norway, or singer-songwriters from South Africa. There'll be music and interviews with Americana artists from a lot of countries that may surprise you. So join me every week for an hour-long musical trip across countries and continents on the International Americana Music Show.
International Americana, Fridays at 8 p.m. and Wednesdays at 10 p.m. on KMRE 102.3 FM.
You know, Miles, Muddy, and Mongo are gone from this earth, but remain a presence in the present with Hacksaw Jazz.
Jazz and blues from RadioPhoenix.org. This is Full Moon Hacksaw.
Yes, chords and scales, but also lyrics and melody. It's Hacksaw Jazz with you Sundays at 8 and Wednesdays at 9 p.m. on KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham, Washington.
Jazz and blues, Full Moon Hacksaw.
At Resources, we promote sustainable communities and protect the health of Northwestern Washington's people and ecosystems using science, education, advocacy, and action. We have launched a new project called Washington Goes Solar to help homeowners and businesses learn about current incentives for home and business solar arrays. More information is available on this project and others at re-sources.org.
You are listening to Cascadia News Now here on KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham, KAVZ 102.5 Deming Van Zandt, and KMRE.org worldwide. I'm Dave Willingham, joined by co-host Tim Johnson and Matt Crow, and we are talking about crude oil exports from Washington State, and that has been quite an issue in the last, feels like forever, with our county council, and it feels like we've kind of been playing moratorium bingo. Where are we with that, Matt?
Well, just a few days ago, last Tuesday, the Whatcom County Council extended a moratorium on permitting any new facilities at Cherry Point that could be used for exporting unrefined fossil fuels. And so that would include coal, and crude oil, various forms of fracked gas. There's some debate there about which kinds of gas might qualify. But essentially, this moratorium prevents permitting from happening while the county goes about the somewhat more difficult and technical business of writing the code into the comprehensive plan updates that would make sure that the county is not overwhelmed, really, by an onslaught of fossil fuel export proposals. And if I can take a moment just to sort of add them all up, we were just talking about the oil train facilities that do exist at the two refineries, oil refineries today. But there's so much more. The Kinder Morgan pipeline, which is a proposal for tar sands or diluted bitumen from Alberta, would bring 595,000 barrels a day of tar sands crude down to BC. Now, they're trying to put it to a port there at in Burnaby. But if they fail, their plan B is to run it through Cherry Point. This would be one of the largest tar sands pipelines in North America, just slightly smaller than, or 75% of the Keystone XL proposal. It's a huge amount of crude that might come this way. Likewise, the Steelhead liquefied natural gas pipeline proposal would bring a huge natural gas pipeline to Cherry Point, run it under the Georgia Strait and out to Vancouver Island. There are other proposals as well. And some, they add up to about 200 million tons of carbon a year, double the carbon footprint of the state of Washington. And so we have our small county here, Whatcom County, and a county council that I think is trying really hard to do the right thing, fighting off a vast quantity of proposals for unrefined fossil fuel exports. Now, we can debate, if you want, about the importance of renewable fuels or electric vehicles or anything else that you want. But one thing that I think we can all agree on is the idea that when we refine the fuels, that's where the jobs that we talk about in Whatcom County actually exist. We have two refineries. One is union, one is not. And they do refine product mostly for us to use. And the idea that we could open the floodgates of crude to foreign markets is actually a direct threat to those jobs. I mean, let's be real, right? There's a difference between the companies that own the refineries and the workers at those refineries. The company's motivation is to make a profit off of receiving crude, transforming it into refined product, and selling it. If they can do that more cheaply overseas with lower environmental standards and lower labor costs than bring the refined product back here, they will.
So it sounds like you're calling attention to what might be perceived as a false flag, because at the council meetings, one of the big cries is that, you know, these exports will create jobs, that there'll be a net surplus in jobs. And you're suggesting that, in fact, this could result in net job loss as these refinery jobs are basically they're outclassed by a refinery job overseas that can operate at a lower cost.
So I think outclassed is the wrong word. I would say outcompeted by removing environmental and human protections. And, you know, to be honest, like the dilbit, the tar sands that might come in much larger amounts is still problematic for refineries. We're just learning how to do it here. The Richmond explosion a few years ago in Richmond, California, that sent 15,000 people to the emergency room was because they were unfamiliar with handling this crude. So, you know, I prefer not to have a whole lot of industrial activity in an incredibly productive shoreline. But on the other hand, we're currently using the products of that crude, and I'd like to make sure that it's under the best and most stringent controls that we can get. If I had the opportunity to rename the council's action, I would call it the Refinery Jobs Protection Act, because that's what it does. It protects refinery jobs from offshoring. We've got a bunch of great folks here. I'd like to see a lot more money go into environmental controls at those facilities. I'd like to see more employment at the same level of throughput. But right now, this is a very real threat. It's a threat to the jobs, and it would be a continuing and increasing threat to the aquatic ecosystems there if we really allow this to grow out of control.
Right. Maybe we can talk for a minute about the Petrogas expansion, because this is one that Petrogas was operating in Whatcom County. Intalco was operating in Whatcom County. Intalco has a pier. They made a deal with Petrogas, and so this kind of slipped underneath everyone's radar and everyone's permitting process, this expansion. Maybe you could unpack that a bit.
Sure. You know, it's when we talk about Petrogas expanding, what we had in the past was a very small facility, and they were making a living taking the gaseous ends, the very lightest part of crude oil from the refining process, and compressing it and selling it as a liquid. What we're talking about now is sort of, I'm not going to say a global phenomenon, but definitely a North America phenomenon, where the ability to frack for oil and frack for gas has produced a whole bunch of these sort of in-between lightweight things that aren't crude oil the way we think of it. It's not heavy crude the way we talk about bitumen or diluted bitumen, tar sands. It's not natural gas or frack gas. It's this sort of in-between thing. And Petrogas is stepping into that and saying, well, there's all this extra stuff. We can bring in a bunch of it, whether it's by pipeline or from the fractions coming in from the oil trains in particular. There's a lot of light ends in the oil trains. That's fracked oil from the Bakken fields mostly, and make a profit by shipping it abroad. So they took over part of the lease, or perhaps the whole lease, from Intalco. I think it's almost 50 ships a year that they can bring into the dock and load with this compressed variety of different types of gas from the, you know, essentially from the fracking process. So it's one of those things where who has the oversight and who's actually watching the hen house is sort of unclear.
What's the essential risks of shipping these kinds of products by rail? Are they particularly volatile?
Well, yeah. I think there's a robust and ongoing debate about how to regulate the volatility of the crude oil that is in these rail cars. And if you go back to 2013, when we had the most egregious example of a tragedy, we had 47 people killed in a railway explosion in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec. The crude in those cars was from the fracked Bakken formation. That's the same stuff that comes here now to BP and Phillips 66. There's been a slight effort to reduce the volatility. And so what happens is, you think about traditional crude, you can see it Beverly Hillbillies style oozing out of the ground. You have sort of a relatively thick, non-volatile substance. You get a very different substance when you force feed a bunch of fluids and fracking materials like silica and some other things underground, deep, deep, deep underground, and deposits that you couldn't reach otherwise, and push it to the surface, and it comes up, and it has a whole lot of very volatile, very light ends. I was watching a video of a lab that was testing the volatility. They had an open beaker of Bakken crude, which at room temperature was bubbling. I don't mean little bubbles. It was boiling. It was frothing. You know, that's how volatile this stuff is at room temperature. And so there have been a few efforts to try to reduce the volatility of that crude. The Obama administration decided to leave it to the North Dakota Industrial Council to do, and they decided that they would cap volatility at, I think it was 13.6 PSI, which is a higher level of volatility than almost all of the Bakken crude comes out of the ground. It was a meaningless regulation. There's still debate right now with the Federal Railroad Administration, which and the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. They're trying. People are talking about it. But at this point, we still have a very, very volatile product that's being put in tank cars, which is not up to the standards that one would hope they would be, and being shipped right through our communities here.
You kind of bring some of the grim parts of this. I want to ask you about how people can stand up to that. You know, we've had some success locally, and you know, but at the same time, you mentioned Vancouver, and in their port race, energy companies just dropped over $150,000 into the campaigns of their guy who's going to give them what they want. How do local activists who are committed and care make up for that? How do we compete with that?
Well, you know, I think we saw a really very successful effort by the local group Resources for Sustainable Communities going back to 2012, 2013, where people who were deeply concerned about coal exports really worked to reach out and educate the community. And in fact, there were multiple groups at that time. Proposition 2 folks were reaching out, trying to find a way to protect our community. And people really turned out. And I think that as we look at the numbers, we look at how the public actually feels about these projects. The reality is that getting people out to vote is the way that we win. And in 2013, multiple members of the county council, four members of the council now, two, I think, are up for re-election, were elected by record margins, as far as I understand it, largely because people who were concerned about the coal terminal and other issues got out. They knocked on doors. They talked to their neighbors. Many of them turned out for Resources for Sustainable Communities, call to action. And I think we keep seeing that happening. You know, it's surprising to me, and maybe that's my own naivete, but how quickly people are able to recognize the importance of municipal action, whether it's county or city, and really get behind people. We saw a new mayor elected in San Luis Obispo, California. She came to prominence by fighting an oil train terminal there that Phillips 66 proposed. We had another person elected and become the chair of the city council in Benicia, California. Also was one of the leaders in trying to understand the impacts of an oil train facility, spoke out, became a leader on that, ended up becoming elected. We see that as well in Albany, New York, and Baltimore, Maryland. You know, I think the same sorts of people who are interested in doing the right thing for the community and are willing to speak out and willing to take action end up becoming leaders or the people who help them get elected.
Right. Well, circling back to our own elected representatives, one of the features of the most recent extension of the moratorium, they're not just wasting their time twiddling their thumbs. There's actually a study underway, a study commissioned that may provide tools that would allow this council or future councils to evaluate these proposals in the future. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, I know that study hasn't come out yet, but perhaps you can talk a little bit about its parameters and what you might hope this would provide to county permitting and county leadership in the future.
Well, you know, I haven't seen the fully scoped parameters that they have given to the law firm, which I think is Cascadia Law, to direct them on exactly what to research. But I know the intent, and the intent is to sort of get at this thing that happens. And I've seen it happen in all the communities I just named where people won elections while fighting these proposals. I've seen it happen elsewhere in other issues where a industrial proposal, a company with a proposal comes to town and says, we have this incredible thing. It's going to be huge. Yeah, it's going to cause damage, but we're going to build it. You have no choice. Now, what kind of mitigations do you want? Let's talk money. Let's talk quiet zones, for example, for the tracks through town. But we're going to build it. There's no hope. Turns out that's not true. It turns out that counties and cities and their land use authority have the ability to create zoning that prevent things that we don't want from happening. We can't say we don't want, you know, SSA Marine to build Gateway Pacific and put that in the land use code. But we can say unrefined fossil fuel use, these other issues, are not good for the economy here locally, because they're not, and find ways to sort of categorically deny those sorts of land use permits. And so what we're hoping will come from this study is a real understanding of, I hope for a broad scale understanding. I assume they're being given directions to say, okay, looking at county code, looking at the heavy industrial zone that Cherry Point is designated as, looking at who we are, like, they're going to have to narrow it down. But at a very broad scale, the question is, can communities that, say, recognize the concerns about climate change and recognize the tie between industrial projects that would worsen climate change or global warming, do they have the right to say, no, you don't get to build that here? And whatever comes out of that, we will be circulating far and wide to counties and cities around the country, because people want an answer. They want to be able to say, if our community recognizes global warming as a threat, what can we do? Well, Whatcom County is one of the leaders, in large part thanks to our county council, and saying, here's what you can do.
Well, let's talk about the county council for a bit. It's an election year. We've got brand new maps. There's a chance that things could be somewhat different. How hopeful are you? I'm not going to ask you straight up who you're voting for, but how hopeful are you?
You know, it would take a seismic shift in support of Trump for our county council to truly go wrong. I really think that we have a great bunch of four candidates who I support. They are people who are thoughtful. Two of them are running for re-election. I think, you look around the country, you look around the results of the more recent elections, people care, and people are paying attention to the issues that the Trump administration is causing. And I think we're going to see a whole lot more people turn out than expected for a midterm election or in between. We've already seen amazing numbers of people making phone calls and knocking on doors. And anybody who wants to get involved, I would encourage them to get out there, because there's great energy to tap into. And I think we're going to have a really good result, but we're going to need a lot of help to get there.
Right. And I guess the point I would make and push a little harder on is elections have consequences. One of the things that we've seen, if you look at campaign contributions, is the petroleum industry itself is once again getting involved in local politics and giving money to certain candidates. So not to put too fine of a point on it, but this moratorium and some of the work that council is doing right now is potentially at risk in this election, because if there was a seismic shift, as you talk about, then you're going to have a brand new ballgame on county council.
I think that's absolutely right. And we have seen money, we have seen organizations, we have seen self-identified black ops PR firms in town who have been pushing for the coal companies and appear to have also been pushing for the oil companies. And these are groups that are, their mission is to manufacture the appearance of community consent.
I'm sorry, a black ops PR firm?
That's right. And by PR, we mean public relations. You can take a look. The folks who were here in 2012, 13, and 14 were a group called the Saint Consulting Group, tscg.biz. They have videos on YouTube. You might recognize one or two of the folks on their site and videos from people who are still around town. And they were here driving turnout for the initial scoping hearings for Gateway Pacific Terminal, also in Ferndale. There's another group that's in town more recently. I don't know exactly what they're working on, so I won't name them. But yeah, these folks, you take a look at their website, the saintconsultinggroup.biz, TSCG. They specialize in siting waste incinerators and making it look like communities want them. I guess to their credit, they have helped to fight back against Walmarts on behalf of local grocers. But by and large, that's what they do. And I think, you can see some of the PR efforts in the last 5-6 years and recognize that they don't feel quite right. That's because they're not from here.
You know, we've talked a lot about what's going on and what you've done. What are you working on next? What are you looking at down the road? What's the next big thing on the horizon that we're not seeing yet?
Well, you know, there's one big thing that we've been working on for years that seems to be flying under the radar and is still a very real and present threat, and that's the Kinder Morgan pipeline proposal. And, you know, you can say pipeline, and it, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. So to put it in different terms, right now there are 40 to 80 tar sands tankers traveling through the Salish Sea every year, and that means coming out of Vancouver, going west into the Georgia Strait, taking a left, and going down through Harrow Strait, where we see the southern resident killer whales, we see salmon, we see all these other species we care about. You know, it's a narrow seaway. It's got a lot of risk associated with it. We've been lucky so far that nothing has happened. Now, the Kinder Morgan proposal that's on the table is a vast expansion of that export capacity from 73 or so thousand barrels a day of export to 595,000 barrels a day of export. That means 560 more tankers coming down through Harrow Strait. And so this has been fought for years. It's one of the biggest news stories in British Columbia. It almost never seems to make its way across the border, even though our waterways are equally at risk. Harrow Strait is a shared Canadian-U.S. waterway with an international border. All the same animals and fish that we care about are there, the same fishing areas for the tribes. So right now, things are deeply in flux. As of yesterday, we have new news about which First Nations or Canadian tribes are opposed to the Kinder Morgan pipeline. And that really, I think, we're going to see a lot more energy. We're going to see a lot more public conversation about it. And I hope a lot more opposition on the Washington side.
Are we as local people in Whatcom County and in Washington State, are we sort of constrained by that border to involve ourselves in the Kinder Morgan decision? Because it really seems like, as you said, very little of that information trickles back over the border, even though the impacts of that particular project could be immense to Whatcom County and Washington. And yet it seems like our ability to engage that particular issue is limited.
So I would say that of course we're constrained some because we're not Canadian citizens and we don't live in BC. But there's a lot we can do. One of those things, there's a group called Coast Protectors, coastprotectors.ca. It is a coalition primarily of Canadian First Nations and some nonprofits, including my own. And they are raising funds. And those funds are dedicated to First Nations lawsuits challenging the Kinder Morgan pipeline. So if you've got an interest in stopping Kinder Morgan and you want to throw some money that way, these are the folks who probably have the strongest legal challenge to that pipeline of anybody. Secondly, it's our border. It's Canada's border too. We share this border, right? And we have a federal delegation, Senator Cantwell, you know, Senator Murray, both of whom have very strong influence. We have a governor who has close ties with British Columbia. These are folks who should be speaking out for us. Our Coast Guard leads the way on protections of the waterways and in negotiations with both Canada's Department of Fisheries and Ocean as well as British Columbia itself. And so when we talk about our voices, I think it's important that they hear from us. I encourage people to write our senators, to write our governor, and encourage them to do everything they can to prevent the construction of Kinder Morgan. And also to acknowledge the fact that we have a lot of toxics, including crude and polluted bitumen, going through our waterways today, and the protections we have aren't sufficient. They simply aren't. And Canada is certainly not doing their part to contribute on those issues as well. And so, yeah, we do have a voice. We have the ability to speak out, and I encourage folks to contribute to the Coast Protectors.
Is there an endpoint to any of this? I mean, we were talking at the, you know, before about coal trains, and that issue seems to have been foreclosed upon. I mean, in other words, the Pacific Coast is off limits now to massive exports of coal, you know, barring something that unforeseen. Is there an endpoint to this, or is this our life now is fighting these projects?
I sure feel like my life is fighting these projects, but you know, there is an endpoint. And I know not everybody felt hope out of the Paris Climate Accords. And perhaps we feel even less hope when the Trump administration waltzes in and tries to throw them out the door and fails to do so like they failed on so many other things. But the reality is that there was a global commitment. There's never been anything like it. You know, I think it was 100 and 195 nations signed on almost immediately to these accords. Our world is changing, and it's not changing as fast as maybe it needs to, but I think we've actually reached a point of saturation where right now all the fossil fuel development that's going to happen is probably as close as it's going to be to having happened. We understand, you know what I mean. and so in the meantime, we have these companies whose entire livelihood is wrapped up in selling fossil fuels. And so now they're competing with each other for what's left for the next 10, 15, maybe 20 years. And our job is to prevent them from destroying the places we live and love while they in the middle of their dying of their death throes. And so, yeah, I think there's an end point. I think it's probably in the 10 to 15-year range. We're seeing amazing things happening with electric cars. We're seeing some good things happening with biofuels. It's inevitable that we're going to make this change. The question is if we do it fast enough to both protect the places we love and prevent catastrophic global warming.
Well, we're getting close to the end. I guess I'd like to ask you about your organization. It seems to have a much bigger mission and role than merely this or simply this, if you can use those words merely and simply with issues like this. But your organization is dealing with an entire range of environmental issues, forestry, et cetera. Maybe you can detail that in the time we have left.
Well, you know, essentially we work in two tracks, and that is forests and climate. And on the forest front, we've really been dedicated to protecting very large swaths of virgin old growth forest. Some of that is in the Great Bear Rainforest, which was part, you know, there were many other people involved. We spent 20 years protecting the southwest corner of British Columbia. That's a stunning place. So if you go up the Georgia Strait into Desolation Sound and keep going, you'll find fjords, these what they call the spirit bears, the great bears. They're white grizzlies of a sort. We do that kind of work. We've worked to try to prevent corporations from buying products from unsustainable timber harvesting areas. We're in particular interested in protecting the boreal forest. So that's the forest side. The boreal forest is that giant band in the northern hemisphere that basically goes through Russia and Canada and all the way around.
Important.
It's pretty important, especially as a carbon sink and a source of biodiversity. On the climate side, we've really been working on stopping some terrible projects like the Kinder Morgan tar sands pipeline, like oil train projects. But we've been focused in recent years and looking towards the future on making sure that communities who want to say no are empowered to say no, whether that's an individual project that could be sited there, like an oil train terminal, or perhaps they could be a pass-through for a pipeline or another railway. And so we've created a network around the country. It's called the Crude Awakening Network. As for folks who are fighting back against fossil fuel projects, trying to make sure that city councils and county councils, just like we're talking about here, know what they can do to say no and how they can possibly affirm clean energy solutions.
Thank you so much, Matt Crowe, for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Cascadia News Now is produced by Stephanie Contreras. Our fantastic engineer is Devlin Sweeney. Special thanks to Josefina Alanis Mora. And please come and join us at CascadiaNewsNow.com. Join us on Facebook. You have been listening to KMRE 102.3, KAVZ 102.5.